This episode may contain content of a graphic nature, including descriptions of physical and sexual violence against adults, children, and animals. Listener discretion is advised. Hi, everyone. I'm Talia.
And I'm Tanya.
And together we are Crimes and Consequences, a true crime podcast. Hi, Tanya.
Hi, Talia.
Welcome back, everybody, to this week's Crimes and Consequences. Today, I'm going to go back a little bit in time. It's a unsolved murder of six.
Oh, my God.
From 1968. We're going to solve it.
Okay. I love when we do that.
We're going to solve it. It's very sad. It's a very bizarre story. It's weird. It's so weird. If you haven't done so already, I want to ask you guys to take 1 second to hit the subscribe / follow button on whatever lovely app you're listening to us on. And with that, I'm ready.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
Do it.
So this story is from Michigan, where we're from. It's from Goodhart, Michigan.
Oh, where's Goodhart?
It's up north, and this is the summer of 1968.
Okay.
There was a family known as the Robinsons. Do you know this story?
I kind of maybe. I don't
Probably
know much about it.
Mentioning it. Like, yes. I started working on it like a year ago.
Yes.
Their 42-year-old dad, Richard, his 40-year-old wife, Shirley, and they had 4 children. 19-year-old Richard Jr., 17-year-old Gary, 12-year-old Randy, and 1 daughter, 7-year-old Susie. The Robinsons were from the Detroit area, Lathrop Village.
Oh, I know where that's at.
But they had this cottage in Goodhart that was 275 miles north. And they would spend 3 months out of the year there.
Wow, that's nice. Yeah. I wish I had a cottage up north. I could spend 3 months a year.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy. Yeah. And for those that aren't from Michigan, it's pretty common to have cottages up north and spend time there. But 3 months is a very long time.
Yes.
The cottage was at an area called Blisswood. That was a private development of pine logs and birch bark summer houses.
Oh, sounds very rustic.
Located by the dunes of Lake Michigan.
Oh, it's beautiful over there.
So it's the northwest side of the state. Blisswood was in Goodhart, and Goodhart itself only had 500 people.
Oh, tiny.
Yes. Now, at Blisswood, there was a guy named Moni Bliss and his father, Chancy Bliss. They built and lived in Blisswood. They also managed it. On July 22nd in 1968, Moni, and I think he's in his like 40s, told his father that a coon must have died somewhere in Blisswood because there was just this awful smell.
Oh, no.
And it seemed to be coming from the Robinsons' cottage. Moni crawled under the fieldstone foundation of the cottage. And the smell, like, oh, it was horrible. When I say overwhelming, it was just described as just...
like smacks you in the face.
Yes. He's under the foundation. He's walking around and he can't find the dead animal anywhere. Now, this cottage was built in the middle of a dense forest. And when I say a dense forest, I'm talking about the woodland was so thick that when you're walking in it on a sunny day, you really wouldn't be able to figure out where you were because hardly any light penetrated through the trees.
Damn.
There were a lot of deer, bear, beavers, bobcats, possums, porcupines, raccoons, which means there's a lot of dead carcass. But they never smelled anything like this. So a woman named Gladys rented a cottage next to the Robinsons. She was hosting a 3-day hen party where her girlfriends came up and they played bridge and they snacked and they talked. And I'm guessing there was some alcohol, but that would be if I threw the party.
It's a girls' weekend, right? I'm going to start calling them hen parties.
Originally, the women had rented a different cottage. But when they got to that cottage, it had been apparent that some people had recently broken in and used it for some sort of sex party.
Oh, no.
So they got assigned to the cottage by the Robinsons.
We got to clean up in here.
They were having a really hard time enjoying themselves because the constant smell of rotting flesh wouldn't go away. By the second day, Gladys and her friends decided they couldn't handle it anymore. And they went up to the managers of Blisswood Moni and his father, Chauncey. And they said, someone's got to figure out what the heck is going on. Chauncey went to check out the smell while he was watering some flowers. And he agreed, yeah, there's definitely something foul going on. And it's definitely coming from the Robinson's cottage. The front door of the Robinson's cottage was very unique. It was handmade by Moni and Chauncey. And there was this leather strap that lifted the metal bar latching the front door to the Robinson's place. And that leather strap was pulled to the inside, which meant there'd be no way to open the door unless you were inside it, because you need the strap to open it. So they had to find a different way inside. Moni got one of his carpenter friends. It was a local Ottawa Native American named Steve. And together they started trying to peek through the front windows. But there were these really heavy drapes closed, so they couldn't see anything inside. They walked around the back, which happened to be the side of the house that faced the lake. And the back door was padlocked, so they couldn't get in. Moni goes to his truck. He gets a flat bar, and together, Steve and Moni break the padlock.
Oh, shit.
Something they probably now regret. Moni pulls the door open, and Steve stands behind him. The first thing they noticed were flies were everywhere.
Ugh.
Tens of thousands of flies.
Oh, my God.
They covered their mouth and their nose with their shirts as they made their way inside. Like, they're still making them their way inside.
Oh, it's weird.
Walking in, they noticed flies completely covering what looked like a set of bare legs. It was Shirley Robinson.
Oh.
Her legs were protruding from underneath a blanket on the living room floor. One of her feet still had a beige high heel on it.
Wow.
Down the hallway, they peered and they spotted a dark lump that looked like maybe a torso.
Oh, shit.
And that's when they got the hell out of there.
Oh, fuck yeah.
Steve and Moni left and they went and called for the undersheriff. His name was Clifford Fossmore. He was the top guy in Emmett County. Because this is taking place in Emmett County, small county. Call came in at about 3 p.m. on Monday, July 22nd. Moni informed them that there was at least one body in the cottage, and it looked like it'd been there a very long time. Even though the sheriff's deputies were familiar with the Goodharts' cottage, it was so remote that they needed a guy to come and help them get to the scene, which took about a half hour. Not long after the sheriff's deputies showed up, the county prosecutor ended up showing up, the Mackinac City police chief showed up, and a local reporter. This is a very rural, very unpopulated area. When everybody arrived, the cottage door was propped open with a horseshoe by Steve and Moni, and they were waiting in the yard. The scene was unbearable for these officers who hadn't even seen a murder in 10 years. The first thing they spot to the left of the doorway is Shirley. She's lying on her stomach, and there's this red plaid blanket covering everything but her legs. When they lift the blanket, she has a lime-colored dress, and that's been pulled up to her waist, and her underwear were rolled down to her ankles. Her whole body was just covered with flies.
Oh, man.
The cottage windows were covered with flies. There were dead flies all over the floor. On top of the dead flies were buzzing flies. As the officers made their way down the hallway, they came upon three more bodies. The first one was Richard, the father. And then there was a boy and a young girl. And they were piled almost on top of each other.
That's weird.
As they made their way to the back bedroom, in the doorway, they found a teenager on the floor. In his hands were some cards. More cards were found scattered around him. And then inside that bedroom was another teenage boy lying on his back. His arms were stretched above his head and cards surrounded his body. Someone had massacred all six members of the Robinson's family. In the living room, something caught the sheriff's attention. He grabbed a paper towel from the kitchen and he picked it up. It was a bloody claw hammer.
Oh, shit. Oh, man.
Between the stench and the flies, the scene was just too much for the officers. And so they're trying to get some of these windows open. But some wouldn't open. So they ended up smashing them in order to breathe.
Oh, God.
gas masks were eventually brought in.
Can't even imagine this. These poor law enforcement officers. You're in some little tiny town. You don't expect to find this shit. You're not from some big city where crazy shit happens all the time.
And then wait till I tell you some more of the details.
Shit.
As one of the officers went to break a window, he noticed on a glass pane next to the front door, there was a note that somehow no one had seen before. It wasn't on writing paper, but it was on a piece of paper towel. And it read, quote, "We will be back July 10th, the Robinsons." Now, this is July 22nd. The window had three cracks in it that looked like bullet holes. In a police report from that day, it said, quote, "It is noted that a window on the east side has three holes in one of the panes. They are all the type that's made by a bullet. There's a piece of paper affixed to the glass with tape. And the center of this paper has that quote, be back by July 10th. Based on the evidence, it's believed the bodies of the Robinsons family had been there for 27 days.
Oh my God.
The gas furnace had been left on.
No.
The windows were closed, the drapes were pulled, the doors were locked, and the lights were shut off. The cottage was filled with carpenter ants, millipedes, microscopic fungi, random bugs, maggots, and of course the flies.
Girl, I have the creepy crawlies.
It's so horrible.
These poor people.
Oh, I know. Oh my God.
I don't know almost which is worse. Bugs give me the creeps.
This whole thing's so awful.
Oh.
In the driveway were the Robinsons' two cars, and they were covered with pollen. And as I stated before, 40-year-old Shirley was found laying face down in the living room with only one shoe on. Her other shoe was in a chair nearby, and it looked almost as if it had been tossed there. Her legs were spread apart, and her toes were pointed towards one another. And I had said that her panties were down by her ankle, but when they looked at her further, they realized that they'd been cut by something jagged. And for whatever reason, her killer or killers decided to put a blanket on top of her. Now, just down the hallway, I told you there was 42-year-old Richard. He was lying on his stomach. His cheek was pressed against the furnace register, which had been on.
Yeah.
On top of him was Randy, the youngest of their sons, and his legs were resting on his dad's shoulders.
Okay.
So he'd been placed there. In a little bit of space between the wall and Randy, we keep in mind he's on top of his dad, was 7-year-old Susie. Now, 19-year-old Richard Jr., he went by Richie. He was the one just down the hall by the bedroom. He was on his stomach. His arms were twisted really strangely. He had been enrolled at Eastern Michigan University, and he was meant to take over his father's advertising business, which I'll get to in a little bit. In that same bedroom, with his arms extended like he'd been trying to grab something just out of his reach, that was 17-year-old Gary. And he was wearing a suit jacket, which is kind of strange, and it was bunched around his shoulders. Once all the bugs and the flies were cleared out, they could see bloody drag marks and bloody footprints throughout the cottage. There was just one set of footprints. In the corner of the living room table was a deck of cards, and from what they could surmise, it appeared that two of the boys had been playing a double game of solitaire when somebody interrupted them. Police began questioning Moni. He's the caretaker there.
Oh, sure.
And their biggest question was, hey, Moni, that smell that's going on, like, why'd it take you so long to get around to dealing with it? And then he told them, hey, you know, I just thought there were some dead animals. When they talked to him more, he recalled the last time he remembered seeing the Robinsons. It was June 24th. The date stuck out in Moni's mind because his 17-year-old son, named Norman, had died the day before during a motorbike accident. Richard Robinson had stopped by Moni's cottage to give his condolences and a $20 bill for some flowers for the funeral. Richard apologized to him, saying that the family wouldn't be able to attend the funeral because they were leaving on a trip. Richard handed Moni the keys to the cottage in case he needed to take care of anything. Police wondered how come Moni didn't question the fact that the Robinsons' two cars were in the driveway when they were supposed to be gone. And by the way, the Robinsons are on a trip.
Right. Where are they going?
They're taking a trip.
They're taking a vacation from their vacation?
Yeah. Well, Richard had a pilot's license, and he flew. He knew how to fly small planes. And in fact, he would often fly his family around on a plane for nice. Business. I know, right? Nice. So Moni's like, oh, I thought he took a plane. Next, officers talked to Moni's dad, 84-year-old Chauncey Bliss. Chauncey said the last time he talked to the Robinsons, they said they were flying down to Kentucky and then to Florida. He admitted he'd seen the bullet holes in the window earlier, but just assumed some troublemakers had shot some, like, pellet guns through it. While investigators are working the scene, a man named Manny Nordstrom shows up. He was drunk off his ass. He was acting kind of crazy. He was talking really fast. He was saying he's friends with Richard, blah, blah, blah. And he suggested to the officers that they talk to a man named Joe Scalero, because Joe worked for Richard and he was basically his right-hand man. As the police are talking to Manny, they notice smoke coming out of the cottage's windows and door. And at first they thought it caught fire, but it wasn't a fire. It's so strange what was happening. Some particles of flesh from the bodies that were on the furnace register were falling into the furnace and burning.
Oh, fuck. Really?
Yeah, what the hell?
Oh, God, I'm so fucking grossed out.
Crazy?
Oh, my God, I'm going to throw up. This is disgusting. These poor people.
As they're looking around the scene, investigators found 4.5 boxes of 22 caliber rifle cartridges, which belonged to the Robinsons. They had some Mossberg rifle. They also found 4 fired 25 caliber bullets, 11 spent shell casings, and none of that belonged to the Robinsons' guns. Bullet holes not only tore through the window, but they also tore through the yellow upholstered chair, the braided floored rug. They cracked a record album and they splintered the wood floor. Police figured out that at least 2 weapons were used. So they surmised maybe there's 2 shooters, but then there was only 1 set of bloody footprints. It took until 10:30 the next morning before they decided they could release the bodies of the Robinsons from the scene.
Oh, man.
Who would want to kill this family that just had a summer cottage? Investigators didn't know what to make of the scene. The idea of a robbery didn't make any sense because the Robinsons had expensive camera equipment and they had expensive cars that were all left behind. The only thing missing was Shirley's 3.25-carat diamond ring.
That's a big-ass ring.
That same day, Emmett County prosecutor wrote, quote, "We don't know anything. We don't know how it was done, why it was done for sure, exactly when it was done, and we certainly don't know who did it at all. All we know is it was done," end quote.
That's a vote of confidence in law enforcement. What
is that?
They should have just wrote, "We don't know anything." The end.
That's basically what they did. In 1968, Emmett County didn't have a morgue, and the bodies were too degraded to be allowed into a hospital. They ended up deciding to make a makeshift morgue out of a chicken coop.
That's unbelievable. A chicken coop?
A chicken coop. A pathologist named Dr. Webster did the autopsies. He spent 4 hours and 26 minutes on the 6 bodies.
Oh.
I can't imagine there was a lot left. Right?
Man, God bless pathologists, man.
Each family member died of gunshot wounds to the head. But a crescent-shaped wound on Susie's head evidenced she'd been struck with a carpenter's hammer, a claw hammer.
Yeah.
And shot.
On Susie? The 7-year-old?
Yeah.
Damn.
Shirley's Hamilton watch stopped at 6:40, but who knows what day. Richard had 2 gunshot wounds to the chest and 1 to the head. Investigators believe that whoever killed the Robinsons staked them out in a spot in the woods, not from their cottage, and then shot the family through the window with a rifle, which probably caused extreme panic to everybody inside. And then the killer or killers entered the cottage and just killed the rest of the family. Here's what they pieced together as prior events to the murder. And it gets really weird. On June 16th, the family traveled in 2 cars from their home in Lathrop Village to that cottage in Goodhart. On June 23rd, Shirley spoke to her mom and she said they're having a great time. She didn't mention anything about going on a family trip or anything. The next day, the family went shopping. When they returned home, they found out that Moni's son, Norman, was killed. And Richard went and gave him $20 for the funeral. And then said, you know, we're going to be in Kentucky and Florida, and we're going to be gone for 2 or 3 weeks. The day after that, a tree trimmer named Russell Figg arrived at the Robinson's cottage at about 9:30 in the morning to do some work. Richard told him that the family was waiting for a long-distance phone call to confirm the plane was ready for the trip and that they'd be leaving either later that day or the next day. The tree trimmer sees the family throughout the day and ends up leaving around 4:30. Richard writes him a check for $170. However, earlier that morning, around 10:30, Richard called his banker at National Bank to discuss some finances. He was expecting a $200,000 deposit that day.
What?
Nice.
Nice.
When he found out there was no deposit, and not only was there no deposit, but the money in his business account was almost gone.
Oh, shit.
He was shocked. It's later that evening at around 8 or 9 that some neighbors who lived close to the beach remembered hearing a series of gunshots and the sound of two males and a female voice. They said they assumed someone was shooting at seagulls. I'm like, okay. The next day, the same tree trimmer, Russell Figg, he returned to finish the work. And he was outside until about 5 p.m. And he said he didn't see anybody at home at the cottage. So who is Richard Robinson?
Are you going to tell me he killed everyone?
What?
Did he kill his family?
I'm not telling you what's going on.
Oh, no.
Well, 10 years earlier, he founded a company called R.C. Robinson's and Associates. It was an advertising company for Detroit area businesses. He also published in an art magazine that he owned called Impresario.
Oh.
It was detailing Detroit's culture.
Really?
Really.
Wow.
Okay. He was a devout Lutheran, a strict father, and the kind of husband that painted his wife watercolors and loved opera.
Aww.
He wore starch pressed clothes and three-piece suits, even when he was on vacation. Okay.
Okay.
He didn't smoke, and he didn't drink, and he didn't gamble, and he wasn't into guns. He liked art, money, and prestige. A lot. At least, that's what investigators learned when they first looked at him. But as they scratched through the surface, they found there was another side.
Oh, shit.
Richard. For example, he had an employee, and that employee quit because he said Richard was a dick. Richard convinced him to return back to work, offered him a higher salary, apologized for his behavior, and basically enticed him to quit the new job he had gotten and come work for Richard. A week later, Richard fired him and said, "No one quits on Richard."
What an asshole. Oh, that was really terrible.
That was bad.
Damn.
Other acquaintances referred to him as a tyrant, a schizophrenic, paranoid, and secretive, dogmatic, brilliant genius that's magnetic.
All right.
He was also a womanizer.
Oh, God dang it.
He had a habit of inviting secretaries into his office and then asking them to flip up their skirts so he could admire their legs. Many of them quit because of this.
Yeah, that's pretty creepy.
And it was determined that he had multiple affairs.
Richard.
Before I tell you more about the strange life of Richard Robinson and how much weirder this story gets, we're going to take a break. Investigators looked into this trip that Richard had planned for his family. It was a real estate venture. And they were going to travel by private jet to Lexington, Kentucky, and then they were going to go to Naples, Florida. Although Shirley didn't tell her mom about it, she did tell her best friend, Margaret, that a man was coming to stay with them in Good Heart, and he was going to stay at the cottage for a couple days. And then the family was going to leave with this man, and they were going to take a trip south together. Shirley told her friend, "I need to make sure the cottage looks presentable for this special guest." But Margaret couldn't remember the name of who this special guest was. All she knew was that Shirley said she'd never met this man before. And so Richard had him call Shirley to put her at ease.
This is very weird.
When she spoke to the man on the phone, he said, "I want you to relax and don't make a fuss for me." Though Margaret couldn't remember the guy's name, Richard's father, whose name is Ross, did. He told the police that Richard said that there was a guy named Robert, and that Robert was flying a private jet up to meet them. Richard's father also told police they really needed to talk to Joe Scalero, Richard's business assistant, because he was basically running R.C. Robinson's, and he knew about the trip that was planned. Police asked Joe Scalero what he knows about the trip, and he says, oh yeah, somebody by like the name Mr. Robert was coming to visit them, and they said, what is this about? And he said, beat the hell out of me. It was clear that when Richard was murdered, he was ready for travel. He was dressed for travel. He was wearing a beige safari jacket.
Oh, nice. What does that mean? Is that with like all the pockets and the like buttons
Jurassic
and shit?
Park?
Yeah, like exactly. Like that's what I'm picturing, like a safari jacket.
Yeah, I think a white short sleeve knit shirt and some black trousers. Now, around his neck was a St. Christopher medal. St. Christopher is the patron saint of travelers. I believe that's for Catholics.
Right.
And he's Lutheran.
Hmm.
On the back of this St. Christopher medal was an inscription, but it was basically like scrawled or scratched in. And it read, "To my chosen son, Richard, God bless you, Robert."
That's weird.
Yeah, considering Richard's father's name was Ross. You can imagine Richard's family's surprise.
My
chosen son. A search of Richard's office turned up some really interesting things. Their investigators found a 6-page letter. It was addressed to Robert, and in parentheses, it said, my father.
This is just getting weird.
It's dated May 17th, 1968, and it was handwritten, and it was signed by Richard. I'll just read you a little bit of it, because it's 6 pages. It says, quote, I'm most honored and pleased with the message given by Steamboat Joe this morning. I've instructed Joe not to allow me to, quote, drop my wallet, end quote. Also, if something should happen to me, to take the entire wallet and pass it up to where the other people would know what to do with it. Then he goes on to mumble something about car allowances for his staff at the Impresario magazine and new salary packages. Then it goes on to say, quote, Steamboat Joe has a keen sense of smell. I thank God for you, Father. Your son always, Richard. Then there's a postscript, and he says, incidentally, old Joe's really had a full head of steam this time. He was most controlled. I'm looking forward with great anticipation and love to the day when we finally meet soon. Always, your son, Richard.
I'm getting a super creepy feeling.
Like, what the fuck what, is this?
What, yeah,
what is this?
What?
The letter alluded to some multi-million-dollar business deal in which there was nothing written concretely on paper, but it was about some computerized warehouse operations and airport cultural centers. Richard mentioned a group of investors who called themselves, quote, the Superior Table. I'm sorry.
Like, what is this?
I don't know.
What is
but
this?
But they were going to, quote, make a worldwide organization that would bring complete peace and unity among all countries of the earth, end quote.
Is this some Illuminati shit?
I don't know, but a chart was included in the letter. And according to the chart, Mr. Robert was chairman, and he presided over 5 other investors, Mr. Thomas, Mr. Richard, Mr. Joseph, Mr. Peters, and Mr. Martin.
Hmm.
Investigators learned that a week prior to the Robinsons going up to Goodhart, Richard rented a hotel at the Metro Airport Hotel, and he was there for 3 days alone, and he told Shirley he was out of town on business.
Hmm.
Detectives also learned that Richard and Joe Scalera had approached some managers at an airport on June 6th, a couple weeks before the murders, and they told the managers that a wealthy financier named Mr. Robert was behind a deal they were concocting, and it was going to be building hotels and things around the airport. Richard talked to him a little bit about what they were thinking and told them to expect a call from Mr. Robert with more information about the deal. And lo and behold, a man named Mr. Robert, he ended up contacting the airport managers. Now, there was something weird about the sound of Mr. Robert's voice. It resembled an elderly man. It was a very low, monotone voice, and it spoke haltingly, like almost a robot would. As soon as these managers got off the phone with Mr. Roberts, Richard called them and asked him how the call went. and he seemed very excited. He told them that he was going to be headed up to Goodhart for a while with his family, and in the meantime, if they needed anything, they could contact his assistant, Joe Scalera. Now, Joe Scalera is in his early 30s. He's about 6 feet tall. He had some grease back, black hair, and he wore tailor-made jackets. He'd been working for Richard since 1965, and he was like a real go-getter. He'd gone to Harvard for a year. He studied business and marketing. He worked in publishing with his father. He was in the Army, and he was selected for a secret spy branch, and he was considered a genius.
Huh.
Not long after hiring him, maybe a year or two later, police realized R.C. Robbins, the company, had been ripping off their main client, Delta Faucet. And as a matter of fact, from January until June, right before the murders, the company had only made $3,500 in actual legitimate advertising income. It was basically going under. However, Richard was telling people it was worth $600,000. So you know who was in charge of the books? Joe Scalera. Could he have been so in charge of a company that Richard didn't know that the company's not making any money?
I would find that really hard to believe, considering the type of guy you said he was.
I know.
I mean, he seems very organized and, you know, hands-on, and like he'd know what was going on.
Especially about money.
Yes, especially about money.
Police interviewed the receptionists at R.C. Robinson's, and they said on the day of the murders, Richard called them in the morning, and he was pissed. They thought that the receptionist said it was probably like 10:30 in the morning. So it's going to be right after he found out there was no money in the bank. Joe and him are yelling back and forth on the phone. And then Joe disappears. He's gone until 11 p.m. and no one saw him. He says he went to Cobalt Hall for a plumbing convention.
Really?
Then he walked to the Salamander Bar, and then he went shopping, and then he went home.
Uh-huh.
If he were to have been the killer, he would have had to have driven 275 miles each direction, which is about 5 to 6 hours each way. Something interesting, police were able to determine that it was a 25 caliber Beretta automatic pistol. That was one of the guns used to kill the Robinsons. And the other one was an uncommon 22 caliber Armalite AR-7 rifle.
Wow.
Records show Joe Scalera had purchased two of the 25 calibers, and he also had an AR-7 rifle.
Really?
But when they went to look for him, he didn't have them anymore. And the police were like, okay, Joe did it. This guy did it. But they didn't feel like they had enough evidence. And in truth, Emmett County, it's a tiny county. They're like, we don't want to fucking pay for this trial. That was the truth. They didn't want to pay for it. Joe denied having anything to do with the murders. He took 3 lie detector tests, and he failed them all. Then in 1969, so it's a year after the murders, a witness contacts police. And they said, you know what? I went target practicing with Joe. And when I went, he was using an AR-7 rifle. The witness took the police to this private range that was owned by Joe Scalera's father-in-law. And they were able to dig up an R7 rifle shell casing. And they sent that to the Michigan State Lab. And it was deemed to be a match to the shells found at the murder scene.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know if that's like...
A year later.
A year later. I mean, you know, like bullets, but I didn't like, I don't know. Is that shell casing? I don't know. I'm not a trained professional, but I guess if they say so. Then around that same time, detectives got a phone call from Joe's neighbor. His name was Carl Obrich, and he told them that Joe offered to give him $10, call someone on the phone, and to pretend to be someone else, and he even wrote down what Carl should say to the guy on the phone. When Carl practiced it, Joe said, you know what, no, you're not going to work, because Carl had a thick German accent. So while Carl was still with Joe, they had another neighbor come over named Timothy. And police are talking to Timothy now, okay? And Timothy's like, yes, I made the call. It was a call to Richard. And Timothy got paid $10 to read some lines that Joe wrote for him. The only thing he remembers saying is, quote, I'm calling in regards to the deal we've been working on with Mr. Scalera. And my client has informed me that he will go as much as 5, but no more. And Tim remembers Richard seemed elated. Still, Emmett County's like, this is not... enough. So during the subsequent years, because time goes by, Joe would give interviews. He gave interview to the Detroit Free Press. He said, quote, police told me I did it. And they said, if I didn't pull the trigger, I know who did. And then he went on to say it wasn't him.
Mm-hmm.
Finally, in 1973, Oakland County, which you know is the wealthiest county in the state of Michigan, they get a new prosecutor, Al Brooks Patterson.
Oh, shit, Brooks?
Yeah. And he reviewed the case, and he believed, and I don't know how, but that Oakland County had jurisdiction. And he was getting ready to charge Joe Scalero with 6 counts of murder. Like, it was happening. However, someone tipped off Joe's mom, and of course she told Joe. On March 28th, in 1973, Joe Scalero put a 25 caliber Beretta to his right temple, and he killed himself.
Oh, no. Well, he fucking did it. Who does that?
He left 2 notes behind.
Say I didn't do it?
Well, yes. The first one was on an office door warning his mom, don't go inside. The second one was by his body, and it said, quote, "Dear mother, where do I start? I'm a liar, a cheat, a phony." This poor woman, listen to this. "Any check that any people have out there with your signature on it isn't good because I forged your name to get people off my back."
Oh, no.
"I know I'm sick, but seeking help isn't going to help the people I've hurt. I'm not a killer, and I'm scared and I'm sick. P.S. I had nothing to do with the Robinsons. I'm a cheat, but not a murderer." Well, I was reading some psychologists that were talking about it, and the first thing he says is, "I'm a liar."
Right. Oh, yeah.
So then how do you trust anything else that's written?
That's true.
Since that time, there's been theories as to who killed the Robinsons, if not Joe. Some people question how Joe could have done it because neighbors by the beach heard gunfire at around 8 or 9, but he was home no later than 11, and that's 275 miles.
Yeah, it's impossible.
That's impossible. Many people wondered if it wasn't Moni Bliss. Townspeople were quoted as saying he was a strange guy who liked to talk to spirits. He had a quick temper and he loved to focus on fires.
But what's his motive?
Well, 2 days before, you know, his son was tragically killed, and perhaps he resented Richard, who handed him a $20 bill and said, "My family can't make it to the funeral. We're going on vacation." I don't know.
Well, that seems like a weird reason to massacre 6 people. Including a little girl.
It's true.
Right.
Many people around the town claim they heard Moni through the years saying that Richard and his family got what they deserved. And one resident said Moni was all mumbling incoherently about killing him. But these are rumors in town. Most people chalk him up to just small town gossip. Moni's daughter acknowledged that he was a blabbermouth and his mental health had been deteriorating. And they kind of lived in a dream world. But she said he wasn't capable of anything like that. Then a newspaper article came forward in like 69, and there was an informant who told the reporter he was part of the organized crime circuit, and he overheard a colleague say, quote, "If he hadn't held back on us like he did, we wouldn't have wiped out the whole family," end quote. This informant said that Richard owed the mob $12,000 a month, and he was only paying back $6,000. Okay. Okay.
Okay.
And of course, the big question is, who is Mr. Robert?
I was just going to ask you, what about Mr. Robert?
Well, my best guess is that Mr. Robert and the Superior Table was a creation of Joe Scalero. And it was probably his way of distracting Richard from all the swindling he was doing at R.C. Robinson's, keeping Richard busy with this new project. And Richard
distracted.
Distracted, yeah. And Richard put Joe in charge of R.C. Robinson and Imprezio. So Joe knew at some point this couldn't keep going on. And he knew that Richard was expecting $200,000 from somebody. And probably Mr. Robert, who was supposed to show up at the cottage. And then he got that phone call from Richard and he was trapped in the corner. That's my theory. Just days after the 50th anniversary of the Robinson family slaughter, some of the few original investigators were still alive. They attended this forum in Petoskey, Michigan. They wanted everybody to know what really happened to the Robinsons, and they wanted to put an end to all the rumors and speculation. They said, quote, "One man, Joseph Scalero, was responsible for the Robinson family murders, and he's long dead. 100% right down the line, Scalero, Scalero, Scalero," end quote.
Okay.
So this is what happened to the Robinsons. Really quick summary. Joe Scalero knew he was busted. He grabbed some guns. He drove to Goodhart. He might have even had it planned in advance. He saw Richard sitting on a chair, and he shot through the window and hit him in the chest. Shirley was sitting across from her husband. 12-year-old Randy was standing by his dad while little Susie was playing on the floor. Richard and Gary were playing double solitaire on the table. Like I said, Joe pointed the rifle through the window, and he shot at Richard, got him twice in the chest. Then he shot Gary in the back as Gary was playing cards, so it happened really fast. Everybody's freaking out, running. He enters the unlocked house. He shoots little Susie as she's running away. He shot Randy. He shot Shirley as they're running for cover. The older boys knew in the back bedroom was a rifle in the closet, and so they ran back there. That's why, if you remember, one of the boys was in the bedroom with his arm stretched out like he was trying to get something. But Joe got them before they could get the gun. Seeing Susie was still alive, he hit her in the head with that claw hammer. Why, I don't know, because then he went around and shot each member of the Robinsons family in the head with a .25 caliber. He decided to stage Shirley's body as if she'd been raped, though she probably wasn't. He piled three of the bodies on top of each other. He turned on the furnace. He closed all the drapes. He put cardboard over the bullet holes, locked the doors, shut off the lights, and drove back to Birmingham.
Huh. That's fucked up.
That's fucked up.
Damn.
I got the majority of my information from When Evil Came to Good Heart by Marty Link. It's a book. And then there's other sources that I will list in the show notes. I want to thank you all for taking the time to listen. Thank you, Tanya.
Thank you, Talia.
And you can find us on social media at Hardcore True Crime.
Facebook and Instagram.
Yep. And we have a website, crimesconsequences.com. You can go there to see pictures. And we also have a Patreon that you can join, and you can get a whole bunch of episodes that aren't released to the public. You get early releases, ad-free releases.
You can also become a subscriber through Apple, and they are the same exact episodes as Patreon. So if you listen through the Apple Podcast app, you may want to consider doing that.
Yeah.
Check it out.
Check it out. Why not? And nothing else going on. Anything else?
No, I think that's it.
Well, thank you guys. Stay tuned for next week's exciting episode from Tanya.
Absolutely. Until our next episode.
Don't kill each other.
Bye.